I'm sorry?
Please.
All right, thank you very much. So I thought a little bit about what I should do, and I decided, since I'm here for a couple of months, that I would give an overview of several different projects and even just show you a slide or two on what these physical science oncology centers are in the U.S. So sort of think of this as kind of a brief overview of cancer metastasis modeling, several different projects. So let me start out by giving you an overview of the basic schematic, let's say, of cancer metastasis that you would get in a standard textbook on cancer mechanics, like Weinberg's book. So primary tumor formation is a starting point. That's before it metastasizes. So there are several groups that are doing sort of solid mechanics and agent-based modeling of primary tumor formation. Then the primary tumor pokes through, let's say, a vessel wall, localized invasion. And this step is called intravasation, where the primary tumor is in contact with the blood flow. And this is basically where the metastatic process starts. So interaction with platelets, lymphocytes, and other blood components. And I'll show you a little bit more about that as we go. And then once that starts, then there's transport of these circulating tumor cells through the circulation. And typically, it takes about 1 minute or so for blood to circulate once around your body. So no one knows exactly the fate of each one of these individual circulating tumor cells, but it's a pretty good guess that they really don't make it through the circulation more than once. They either get shredded or they get destroyed, which is the vast majority of them. And then occasionally, a small number of them will get lodged in different organs or capillary beds. And if the seed and soil match is compatible, then you move on to these other steps, which is, in general, a very unlikely event, even if you have a primary tumor. But since there's so many of these circulating tumor cells, that it becomes more likely. So arrest in microvessels and various organs, extravasation into an organ site, formation of a micromet, and then colonization and formation of a metastasis. So those are the steps that, in general, we are modeling. In general terms, we are focusing on these steps around this area right here, because most of the models I build have to do with the flow of circulating tumor cells in the bloodstream and some probabilistic models, the Markov chain models associated with that, that I'll describe a little bit. Okay. So there's several models that I'll tell you about. I'm sure I won't get through all of these. I'll just go till a little bit before noon, let's say. Oh, wait, no, 10:30. A little bit, let's say 11:30. I'll go for an hour at most. So I'll start out by describing what I think is probably going to be pretty familiar to lots of people, this notion of entropy, and how we use it to compare the complexity of different kinds of cancers. And that sort of sets the stage for several of our models, in particular the Markov chain random walk models of metastatic progression that we develop based on random walks of, let's think of them as circulating tumor cells going through the bloodstream. I'll quickly talk about some CFD models of procoagulant circulating tumor cells in the bloodstream, having to do with the fact that circulating tumor cells typically trigger a chemical process which ultimately leads to blood clot formation, and cancer patients often have a higher incidence than normal of having blood clots. So we're doing some CFD modeling of that process. Very briefly, I'll maybe, if I get to it, talk about some low-dimensional deformation models of circulating tumor cells at the intravasation stage. And I probably won't get this kind of a follow-up to this network systemic diagrams, which we're doing now, which is basically cell trafficking models based on evolutionary game theory interaction of cell populations. Okay. So just a very quick introduction to the physical science oncology centers. There are 12 of them in the United States. They started under the director of NCI in roughly 2008. And then they officially started in 2010 under Varmus. And so the first phase was 2010 to 2015. So the first 5 years is ending soon.
Was it always 12?
What?
Was it always 12? I somehow remember.
It was always 12. No, it was always 12. So these are the centers around the United States, and each of the centers has a different focus, although there's certainly some overlap among them. And officially, I am involved sort of financially, let's say, and I'm the main mathematical modeler at the Scripps Research Institute Center, which is in La Jolla, even though I'm a faculty member at USC, and there's a separate PSOC at USC. So this one is, the main physicist there is a guy by the name of Peter Kuhn, who's a circulating tumor cell expert and does fluid biopsies on patients. And he's really a device person who develops techniques to extract and visualize and manipulate circulating tumor cells, and I'll show you a little bit of that in a second. This one, USC, is more, a little bit more, let's say, of a therapeutic kind of a center. It's centered at the Keck School of Medicine. David Agus is the main oncologist who's the head of that. So to some extent, I'm involved with that one as well, but mostly with the Scripps one. A couple of people, so this is our main group in terms of the physics and mathematics modeling, Peter Kuhn at Scripps, and Owen McCarty, who's a chemical engineer at Oregon Health and Science University. He's a platelet person and a blood, basically a coagulation kind of a person. And then oncologists and pathologists at UC San Diego and Scripps. And we also work with Sloan Kettering with a group, a breast cancer group, mostly headed by Larry Norton. And then the graduate students and postdocs at USC doing most of this work. Okay, a little bit of an introduction. So I think of this problem more or less as a particle interaction problem, but a complicated one with biochemical interactions and certainly active particles. So there are many different kinds of particles in the bloodstream that all have different features associated with them. So just to give you a sense of the numbers, the normal white blood cells in the bloodstream, those are the numbers there per microliter. The red blood cells, so white blood cells, I'm sure you know, have nuclei. Red blood cells don't. And then platelets, so there are many, many, many of these. And the white blood cells, there's several different kinds. They all have different kinds of properties. And then there's the circulating tumor cells, which are the keys to cancer progression. And there are very few of these, even in a situation where the patient is in a highly metastatic state. There are very few of these circulating tumor cells. The units here are not wrong. So this is per microliter, milliliter, microliter. There are very few of these. And the key is to somehow use those seeds to develop models. Yeah.
Are they all individual cells? Or?
Well, that's a great question. So the answer is no. They are not all individual circulating tumor cells. I'll show you some pictures of cell clusters. And so we've done some modeling of cell clusters, and there's a lot of unknown territory there about how clusters form, whether those break off from the tumor or whether they form in the bloodstream, which is probably pretty unlikely. But that's a really good question. All right, so just to orient you a little bit more, so if you think of this as the primary tumor pushing through the vessel wall to initiate the metastatic process, then right at the initiation site, which obviously is a somewhat of a simplified schematic here, the tumor is going to be contacting a Stokes flow regime here. It's in the boundary layer of the flow, and so it'll be very high viscosity. And so you can pretty much think of this as a Stokes flow regime as opposed to a Navier-Stokes regime up here. And basically the blood, you typically don't even need to model it as pulsatile flow. It's basically just acting somewhat like a piece of scotch tape, which is just ripping these cells from the primary tumor. And then they enter the bloodstream in this Stokes flow regime, and they seed the vessel, and then they start on their little journey.
Clearly, blood vessels vary in size a lot, but what might be the size of the type of?
Yeah, so I think
blood
I have.
Vessels that might,
let's see, did I have?
I relative to the size of the cells.
I have that in a slide in a couple of minutes. Okay, so people have known about circulating tumor cells. This is kind of the classic paper that that probably is one of the first papers that identified circulating tumor cells in the bloodstream in 1869. It's a famous paper by Ashworth. And as you can see here, I'm not sure how you can, how readable that is. A case of cancer in which cells similar to similar in the tumor were found in the blood after death. Okay, so that was sort of the first notion of circulating tumor cells. I like this phrase too. God, it's hard for me to read it. Like those of the tumors. Let's see. The most singular circumstance was the occasional cells were something, an appearance like those of the tumor. And then there's one other nice thing here.
Unless you know your
background. Fact, the cells identical with those of the cancer itself being seen in the blood may tend to, can you get the next word?
Show.
Yeah.
Shed a new light.
Yeah. So, anyway, you get the idea. You get the idea. It's an old paper. That's why it's so worn out. You know, there really was no particular notion that, that those were the seeds until then. So now, obviously, there's much better techniques. So this is all from Peter Kuhn's lab at the Scripps Research Institute. So what they do is they take fluid biopsies from patients, so little blood samples, which is nice because it's very non-invasive. You can do that every day. You could do that every week. No big deal. You can track cancer patients. They take these slides and they stain them to identify the DAPI stain or the blue. Those are the nuclei of the white blood cells. And the green are stained white blood cells that are normal white blood cells. And then every once in a while, there's going to be a red one that shows up, which is a circulating tumor cell, or a candidate circulating tumor cell, let's say. And then you have to hone in on those and find those, and then extract them. And the group at Oregon does physical measurements on these cells, and there are other groups in the country that do as well. And so you can get the physical parameters associated with different kinds of cells. It's a little tricky, and there's lots of conflicting information about the size and morphology and squishiness and flexibility of circulating tumor cells versus normal white blood cells. So Peter now so has the ability then to look at these different angles, and we can, in principle, use this kind of information in our models. So this would be a lung circulating tumor cell cluster. This prostate circulating tumor cell cluster is just as an example. All right. As I said, the red ones are the CTCs. The green ones are normal white blood cells. Yeah.
What is the dye actually indicating?
The dye, those are different kinds of biostaining. So I think, let's see, the red, the blue is DAPI stain, okay. And red is cytokeratin staining. So the circulating tumor cells are epithelial cells. They come from outside of the blood cell, so they stain slightly differently than other normal white blood cells. The downside of that is that not all of these red cells actually necessarily are cancer cells. They could be from some other origin, but probably fairly unlikely. All right. Okay, so let me start marching through some of these ideas and interrupt whenever you want. So the first thing that we started talking about 4 years ago or so was what is the best metric to use to compare the complexity of different kinds of cancers. So we developed this notion of metastatic entropy, which is based on the following idea. So we got a hold of autopsy data sets from the 1920s and 30s and 40s, this massive data set of about 4,000 untreated cancer patients. So these were really useful data sets because you can think of them as the natural progression of cancer. You cannot get, obviously, that anymore because no one is left untreated anymore. So this was great for us. So what these data sets were, these were the metastatic distribution of tumors over large populations for essentially all different kinds of cancers. So here's lung cancer. These are the number of mets at various anatomical sites. Okay? And we normalize this. This is the number, but we typically normalize that to make the histogram sum to 1. So this is basically the probability distribution function of lung cancer. And this would be the probability distribution function of breast cancer and prostate cancer and colon cancer. And they're all slightly different. They all have slightly different signatures. Just to point out here, if you plot them on a log-log plot, they all have a power law range slightly different. The slope of the power law is not particularly a good way to compare things. But just to point out that they have some sort of power law range, which is more or less a common kind of range that you see in internet node site distributions, which is sort of interesting, particularly with respect to the next model that I'm going to describe. So we thought about how to compare the complexity of these different signatures to start out with. And so the two main drivers of metastatic complexity, there would be two things. One would be the number of metastatic sites in which the cancer spreads to. The more sites, in some way, the more complex the cancer is. That isn't the main thing. The main thing really would be the probabilistic distribution to those sites. So for example, a flatter distribution where each of these sites are relatively equal in probability would clearly be a more complex and less predictable situation than one in which there's a very steep distribution where one site would have a very high probability as compared with other sites. With me? So those are the two ingredients that we wanted in there. And for those people who have worked with entropy, the perfect way to compare that is using the standard information theory or STAT-MAC entropy formula, where the PIs is the percent of metastatic tumors at site I. Okay? It's a very simple, nice way of comparing. So just to remind you, sorry for people who are experts here, the entropy would be some number between 0 and log n. And the lowest entropy state would be one in which there is a primary tumor at a certain location and no metastatic tumors. So the probability would be 1 at a single anatomical site, in which case the entropy would be 0. And the worst scenario, which you never see, would be a maximum entropy distribution in which the sites are all equally probable. Okay?
Excuse me. Is there anything arbitrary here in what you call a site? Like, is the site, the lungs or the left lung and the right lung are two sites?
So I would say it's somewhere between not exactly precise and but not arbitrary. So basically, we take the autopsy data set and we use the classification from the autopsy data set. Okay, and that's pretty good. I mean, you know, lung is one, liver, adrenal gland, lymph nodes, distant lymph nodes. The downside of an autopsy data set would be that if there's a met in the bone, it doesn't say whether it's in the left femur or whether it's in your arm, or it doesn't have the location there. So that's a whole separate story, right? So it's not arbitrary, but it's not tremendously precise. There's about 50 sites, 50 anatomical sites in the body, brain, and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, on a similar note, I mean, obviously, I'm pretty certain it's not part of your anatomical data set, but I mean, if you're talking about statistical weights, you would also like to know how much the site is affected. Like, I suppose, that, for example, lung being completely, I don't know, ravaged in lung in lung cancer, as opposed to maybe finding some
nodules.
Right, right. What you're asking for is finer and finer data on these sites, and that would all be fantastic. You have to keep in mind this is 1920s, 1930s, 1940s autopsy data set. We use what we have. And even if you have up-to-date longitudinal data sets like we're using now from Sloan Kettering, there is no great data set out there. Trust me, there's no great data set. They all have tremendous problems with them. But on the other hand, they all contain lots of information. You never get what you want. All right. So first thing we did was we lumped all the different kinds of cancers together to have some sort of a benchmark to compare with. So all cancers together, this is the metastatic distribution of all cancers. And I don't, again, I don't know how well you can see it, because I can't even see it that well. Regional lymph nodes, distant lymph nodes, liver, lung, bone, adrenal, and so forth. Okay? This is the signature of all cancers, entropy of 2.714. That would be the maximum entropy for 30 sites, which is what this is. And so we look at that as our benchmark, and we want to know what cancers are more complex than the generic, or less complex than the generic. All right? And so here would be a listing. We basically categorized, I think, 15 different kinds of cancers. So breast cancer typically is one of the most complex, 2.78, higher than average. Skin would be even higher than breast. Lung cancer, also one of the most complex. One of the simplest would be prostate cancer. This is about the lowest entropy cancer that you have. And you can see it clearly in the signature here. Prostate drops off very quickly, breast and lung much less quickly. Okay? And that correlates beautifully with something I'm going to tell you about, which are these reduced Markov progression diagrams for each cancer type. It completely correlates the entropy with the complexity associated with these reduced models. So here's the whole list of the cancers that we've looked at, from highest entropy to lowest entropy. Those are the number of sites. So skin cancer would be at the highest end of the scale, as I said. Prostate cancer would be at the lowest end of the scale. And we have reduced diagrams that I'll tell you about and explain in about 15 minutes or so for each cancer type. And here would be the all of them lumped together. So these would be the cancers that are, let's say, above average complexity. These would be below average complexity. Not that that necessarily means that they're harder to treat or that they're more deadly. That's a separate issue. I've given this talk in front of some prostate oncologists, and they've been very annoyed at this. All right. So let me tell you a little bit about how we use that. So the next thing is Markov chain random walk models of metastatic progression. So the question is, what is the dynamical system that drives metastatic progression from a state of low entropy to a state of high entropy? So now what you should be thinking of is this, and this is where I have some units that you can look at. So red blood cell capillary, CTC, human hair, artery. Those would be typical sizes. So what you should think of is this. You've got a primary tumor forming somewhere. It enters the bloodstream and starts shedding circulating tumor cells, which are circulating around once or twice, or maybe more than that. And occasionally, they get lodged at different sites and then start developing metastatic tumors, possibly. So the first kind of thing that we realized was that in order to mechanically and biochemically model all of the steps that were associated with this process was a completely hopeless thing to do. Completely hopeless. So what we did was we tried to build random walk probability models based on this concept, which in some ways should incorporate all that information. So here was our idea that we started developing 4 years ago. And that is that we treat this problem basically the way Google search algorithm works in the following sense. So in the Google search algorithm, all of the websites are nodes, and there are edges, which are transition probabilities from site to site when you're surfing from site to site. And Google, of course, so nodes are the web pages, the nodes are linked by directed edges. The edges have weights, which are the transition probabilities in a Markov model. And Google is constantly monitoring these edge weights with web crawlers. And what they do is they compute the steady state distribution of a Markov chain process in order to get the weights of these nodes, given the edge weightings. Okay? And that's how they rank these. And it's constantly changing because these edge weightings are constantly changing. So they're getting estimates of these edge probabilities and computing this steady state distribution and constantly updating. Their whole thing is to do this steady state calculation very, very quickly because they have such a large data set. Ours isn't that big a deal. It's not that big. So they use this kind of a model to perform simulated internet searches. Individual searches would be with random walks. ensemble searches with Monte Carlo simulations. You can then run tests under different scenarios by, for example, changing the edge probabilities, deleting some of the nodes, like in a percolation kind of a question, and then see what happens globally. And you can calculate mean first passage times from site to site and things like that. So those were all incredibly useful ideas for us. So what we did is something very similar to that. For us, the anatomical sites are the nodes, and we imagine that they're all linked by some unknown directed graph edges, and our goal is to estimate what those transition probabilities are. Okay? So for us, the nodes are the potential tumor sites, and they're linked by directed edges, and we need to construct the edge weights. So similar uses for our model: perform simulated cancer progression simulations, individual progression with random walks, ensemble progression with Monte Carlo simulations. We can run tests under different scenarios, which has proven to be really useful, sort of hypothesis testing what happens if we remove the adrenal gland and primary lung cancer in terms of mean first passage times to all these sites and so forth. And we can do all these calculations and quantify things.
Yeah. We are going to use the anatomical in the autopsy data set that
yeah.
you mentioned, right?
Well, we do. What I'm going to describe today is the use of the autopsy data set as a steady state distribution to infer the edge probabilities that get us to that steady state. However, we do other things like take longitudinal data sets, which are tracking a cohort of patients from time to time, and from those, you can compute the edge probabilities directly.
So the thing that I'm trying to turn my head around is that you had 4,000 or so data sets, right? 4,000 or so people?
4,000 or so patients.
And 30 nodes. Is the problem invertible, given that this is the steady state
right,
distribution?
Right. Yeah, I'm not actually going to tell you what our technique is so much, because it's a little too detailed, but great question. Let me just say a word about that when we get to that distinction. But yeah, it's definitely a good question. It is invertible. It's just a non-unique situation, so you have to figure that out a little bit.
My concern is a little bit different. I mean, if the final state of the dissected person, that's not a steady state, right?
Yeah. So what would you do? So I agree. I agree.
Snapshot in time, like when the patient died.
Yeah. Excellent question. Definitely, that has been asked before. So. What we're doing is we're taking time zero to be when there's a single primary tumor and no mets, and we're taking time infinity to be when the patient is dead, so that there's no more progression of the disease. So we're building a dynamical system which takes us from time zero to time infinity based on that information. That's what we're doing. I mean, I think you would agree that cancer is not progressing anymore once the patient dies.
No, definitely. But definitely. But I mean, the idea of doing this, I guess, is that you could have further metastases from some of the metastatic sites. Is that it? That's okay. I'll talk to you after.
Yeah.
I mean, you explain it.
So it's not constrained by the anatomy of the individual. In principle, you have a cancer cell in your toe can interact with one in your brain or whatever. You don't put any restrictions with the anatomy.
Of the individual?
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of everything looks like it can interact with everything else.
No, definitely not. No, these are not connected, for example.
But as a result, do you restrict it in the
same No, we don't.
It's just a result from
the... Yes, it's a result from the method that we use. Yes. Okay, so one slide on Markov chain basics. Probably many of you know it, maybe some don't. The Markov chain dynamical system is driven by a transition matrix, A, let's call it, which is a matrix of information that where the entries, the rows sum to one. It's a stochastic matrix, so the rows sum to one. And the rows give the transition probabilities from site to site. Okay? The basic variable is the state vector at time step k. And the multiplication of the state vector with the transition matrix gives you the next time step, k plus 1. So the standard Markov chain dynamical system is a discrete dynamical system, but there's nothing particularly to restrict you to discrete. You could also make this continuous, and we work a little bit on continuous models as well. This is the simplest, nicest thing to do. So the states in this system would be the anatomical sites, And in some of the models, we take deceased as one of our states in this vector. But in this particular thing, I'm going to show you that is not a state, because everybody ends up in that state, absorbing state. So the initial state would be a 1 at the location in which the primary tumor is. And the transition matrix that we use is associated with the kind of cancer that we have. So we build a transition matrix for lung cancer, we build a different one for breast cancer, and so forth. We don't have one transition matrix for all cancers. We can, but that really washes out a lot of information. So primary state, steady state would be the autopsy data set in the simplest example, and so forth. Okay? Just ask questions if you... Yeah, sure.
This final state, steady state, is it known whether these patients die from lung cancer or
That's another great question. So probably the answer is the vast majority died of cancer, but there's probably some people in that data set that did not die of cancer. That's another great question. That is something that you always grapple with a little bit. I mean, we're, as I said, we're looking at this longitudinal data set from Sloan Kettering, and we are talking, we're going back and we're trying to see which of these people died of cancer. And as I say, most of them died of cancer, but some didn't. And so typically we would try to remove those data sets, those people from the data if they died from something else. But you could model something along those lines as well, but it becomes tricky if you die from getting hit by a car, for example. Okay. So how to compute the entries of the transition matrix? So I don't like the word compute so much. Better word would be to estimate, because every data set's going to give you different estimates of these transition probabilities, and you're constantly updating these estimates based on more and more information. So in a real sense, this is basically a baseline model where we estimate our first prior distribution would be our estimates based on the autopsy data set. And then we use data assimilation methods to update our estimates on these entries. But so there's basically two ways to do this. So we need transition probabilities from site to site. Two ways to do this. Yeah, sure.
So you need both the initial diagnosis of the single starting cancer as well as the final.
Yeah.
That's available in the data.
Yes. Yeah, that is available. Okay, so there's two ways to do this. This is the way we use the autopsy data set. We reconstruct the transition probabilities from the steady state information and get the, let's call it, the most likely transition probabilities, which will get us to that steady state. And a better way, in many ways, is to do a direct empirical calculation if you have a longitudinal data set. So if you have a cohort set that you're tracking in time, it's pretty straightforward to compute these empirically. The problem is that this is a whole different problem, because now you're talking about patients that are being treated under different kinds of scenarios, which of course is interesting and something we model, but that's not a baseline model the way this is. So you cannot do this and develop baseline models. All right, so I'm not going to tell you how we reconstruct that so much. But what we do is we create these transition matrices that gives us a directed graph where the sites are on the site. So we organize things so that our primary cancer, in this case lung, would be at 12 o'clock. And we look at these, that's the full diagram, and we can do all kinds of analysis on those. So let me just show you, for example, a key thing here is how fast the system converges to the steady state. So this would be a lung cancer Markov chain progression. So we start with an initial state, this is k equals 0. With probability 1 at the lung site, this goes up to 1. But, and this is the steady state distribution that our model is designed to go to. Okay, so after one step, after two steps, after five steps, after 10 steps, after 25 steps. Very fast convergence, which is going to be key to how we compute, how we develop reduced Markov diagrams. Yeah.
Is it obvious with these transition rates being asymmetric that you always get into a stationary, into a steady state?
Is it obvious that there's always a steady state distribution associated?
Yeah, next to a steady state, I mean, the transition rates are asymmetric, right? I mean,
if
the transition probability from one to
the other. Yeah. So that these transition matrices are not symmetric. They do always have they're designed so that they have a left eigenvector with eigenvalue 1, because that is the steady state distribution. That's how we design them. We design them so that this steady state distribution is an eigenvector of the transition matrix with eigenvalue 1. So I'm not going to say it's obvious. I'm just going to say that's how we design it.
Not all matrices would have.
No, certainly not. Absolutely not.
So if I understand correctly, each of these metastatic sites are nothing but the node weights that you
choose. You were correct.
So do you also have a similar diagram for the edge weight? How does that evolve?
No, the edge weights are not evolving. We compute the edge weights. That gives us our transition matrix, and that's set in stone. And then that transition matrix is what drives this dynamical system. So I certainly have lots of diagrams of these edge weights, but that's not evolving in time.
I'm sure this is a stupid question, but
what
does the matrix give for the connectivity between the prostate and the uterus?
you got me on that. No.
I mean, those are two sites. I mean, two.
No. Okay, great question. So no, you would not have any connection between the prostate and the uterus when you create a prostate model, and that's because.
Well, no, but even for the lung cancer model, the prostate and the uterus are two different sites.
Right. But remember that these transition matrices are built from the autopsy data set, and there's no data point in that data set with a metastatic tumor in both the prostate and the uterus.
Right.
So you only would have a connection if there are mets in those two places. So there's no data, uterus is not in the prostate model as a site.
Say it again? There's some gender-related organs there which maybe don't want to connect.
Right. As I said, not all organs are connected by edges. And in the prostate model, this is the lung model, by the way.
Yeah. But I mean, in the lung model, there's the prostate is connected to the lung, and the uterus is connected to the lung.
In the lung model. Let's just check. Is uterus in here?
I see them both there around the
okay.
middle.
Fine. There's men and women that are both in this data set that died of lung cancer.
Right. Yes, I'm sure there are. And so I'm just trying to figure out how the model deals with that.
I don't understand your question. How it deals. This particular lung cancer model is not gender specific. It lumps females and males together. This is a lung cancer model that doesn't. It's not a model for male lung cancer patients or female lung cancer patients. We could do that, no problem. The problem with the more you isolate your subgroups, the less sparse the data becomes and the bigger the error bars become. So it's a trade-off between the number of people you put in a bin. In lung cancer, I think we have something like 400 or so patients out of these 4,000. There's 400 or so that had primary lung cancer. And my guess is that roughly half are female and roughly half are men.
Sure.
I just want to paraphrase Jonathan's question to see if I can understand it.
Yeah.
I'm constructing a matrix, right, where I basically choose B0 to be 1 in the lung. So I pick an initial condition along one axis of my coordinate system.
Yeah.
And then I want to construct the matrix that takes this initial condition to whatever the final distribution is.
Yeah.
Right? So there is a matrix element there that is uterus, prostate. Right? If I just think of all of these sites as vectors in my mm-hmm. vector space. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I thought the nodes were chosen specifically.
The nodes are chosen specifically to include only the nodes that are associated with the data set. So there will be no uterus node in the prostate model, unless there happens to be a woman in the data that died of prostate cancer. I mean,
Okay, I'm not so there's no question right. So
yeah, I mean, we can talk about how we construct this transition matrix later.
If I understand correctly, just the initial ground shift doesn't have all possible connections, it has only the ones which appear in your data set.
Is that a question? Or?
I'm just trying to understand if that's what the situation is.
Yes, that is a situation. Yeah. Yes, it only has the nodes that are in the steady state distribution. We wouldn't include nodes otherwise. You with me? Yes.
So it is that there's no time scale associated with it.
Okay, that's a separate issue. That's a great question. We can, once, there is no time scale in this model. We can compute mean first passage times, which are model time scales, and then we'd have to do a separate comparison with other data set, which would compare the time scale of a longitudinal data with our model, and in which case we could associate the steps, K, with actual time scale. But you're totally right. In this, this is model time scale.
And even for each cancer type, they have all different times.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's a whole separate question. You can think of this as a spatial distribution, and this gives you the spatial information, but it doesn't in itself give temporal information because that's not, let's just say that's not calibrated yet with an external data set. Totally right. All right. Okay, so that gives us network diagrams, as I said, and these would be four examples of network diagrams, lung, breast, prostate, colon. You can see immediately the complexity of these different cancers just from the density of these graphs. Lung cancer and breast cancer are much denser than prostate cancer. But key to a lot of what we do is the following fact. We can compute the convergence rates to the steady state, and as I showed you, they converge very, very quickly, all with slightly different rates, but the key is that they all almost have completely converged in two steps. Okay, so we think that two steps in this progression tells most of the whole story. Not the whole story, but most of the whole story. Okay, you get very, very good convergence after two steps. And so we use that for each cancer type to build these multi-directional pathway diagrams. So everything starts out at the center in the primary, which would be lung. The first step out would be these arrows. And at 12 o'clock is the most likely step, which in this case is lymph nodes, regional lymph nodes, adrenal. So it gets less and less likely as you go around the clock. This would be a self-seeding step, lung back to lung. So this would be the first step out. The second step could go to a second site, or it could go back to itself, or it could go back to the primary. Okay? So from these kinds of diagrams for each cancer type, we can then simply compute the probability of all of the two-step paths from lung, just by multiplying all of the possible two-edge probabilities. And we come up with a listing of 1,000 or so two-step paths ranked from most probable to least probable, and we can then cut off that two-step pathway diagram at any level that we want and produce metastatic pathway diagrams and reduced models. Okay, so just to be clear, metastatic pathways would be the steps in a progression, and so each of these pathways has a different probability associated with it. And from that, we can compute reduced Markov models. Yeah.
So just to understand this process better, so when there is a tumor in lung,
mm-hmm. a primary tumor in lung,
and let's say the first region that it metastasized is on the kidneys. Now, the diagram, if I understand correctly, it would say that the tumor in the kidney is not the one which is metastasizing elsewhere, but again, it is central lung tumor which is metastasizing.
Right, so right.
That the center of metastasis now is not liver.
Right. It would be the primary. It's always focused on the primary tumor.
Okay.
And this progression diagrams are the time order of the sequence of metastatic sites. I can't tell you whether the actual cells have gone from the first metastatic site to the second metastatic site, or whether the actual cells came from the primary tumor and went to the metastatic site. That's beyond the capability of this model. But
so just stepping way ahead, so like how important is this?
How what?
How important is this? Like maybe like in the primary tumor site, which is lung.
Yeah.
Maybe liver tumor is acting as a source for other metastatic sites.
Right.
Is that important?
Well, what is important is the categorization of metastatic sites as either spreaders or sponges. And that categorization does have to do with where the primary tumor is. So that's an important piece of information that we get from these kinds of models. Okay, so the question we're trying to answer here is which metastatic sites would make the best targets for therapy? Yeah.
So
when you say K equal to 2 being sufficient, can you quantify this? I mean, for example, what percentage of total weight of hard waves is connected in two steps?
Absolutely. I'll show you that in a second. Okay, so which MET sites would make the best targets for therapy? So we do something very simple. We take these two-step diagrams and we list them in terms of probabilities, and we look at each site, and we categorize each site as a spreader if the probability out over the probability in is bigger than one, or a sponge if it's less than one. This is an incredibly simple thing to do. And we take these two-step diagrams and we reduce them by taking, for example, I'm showing here, would be 30-step diagrams. So we're taking the top 30 two-step pathways, and we are coloring each metastatic site as a spreader or a sponge. Red would be spreaders, blue would be sponges. And to answer your question, these top 30 sites, we're also putting the percentage of the whole story that these top 30 sites, the top 30 pathways capture. So in lung cancer, since it's a complex pathway disease, the top 30 sites cover about 37% of the story. I think it covers a lot more than that, but that's the number. And in prostate, the top 30 sites cover 81% of the story. It's another reflection of the fact that this is a much less complex disease. Did you have a question?
The in and the out includes all incoming and outgoing pathways?
Yes, yeah, and their probabilities, right. Okay, so as you can see, the key is sort of the 1-2 punch of a certain cancer, the primary plus the first spreader site. So for lung cancer, that would be the adrenal gland. For breast cancer, it would be bone. For colon cancer, it would be liver. And for prostate cancer, it would be bone. So we group together the primary with the first spreader site that it goes to. And we've got a paper on this whole lung-adrenal connection story. And there's a little bit of literature on whether or not you should resect the adrenal gland for primary lung cancer patients. And it's a little controversial, and so we think we can shed light on that, at least from the point of view of modeling. Okay, so I just went through those percentages. So we can also completely categorize all of the paths that are the spreader diagrams from each of these primaries, each of these sites. And here I just want to show you what I said earlier, and that is we think of these transition probabilities really as random variables. They're not just fixed numbers. This would be the transition probability from lung to adrenal, from prostate to bone, breast to bone, colon to liver. So these are the transition probabilities that we use from primary to each of the spreader sites. And they're roughly, roughly Gaussian, who knows. But we typically take the mean value as our variable. But in principle, we could develop more complex models where we treat those as random variables. All right, targeting the spreaders. So we did lots of different things. Here's just an example of the kind of things we can do. What would be the response if we could therapeutically target the spreaders? So for example, in our models, we change the spreader to an absorbing state. And we look at what the mean first passage times to all the other sites are when we do that, and we see whether the entropy decreases or increases. So these are diagrams that show the mean first passage time from the primary to each of the other sites. We just take the top 8 or 10 sites. And when we do that, when we change the main spreader to an absorbing state, we not only decrease the entropy, but we increase typically the mean first passage time. So we have a little bit of an impact when we do that. And we haven't. And there's a complicated issue of whether, you know, what site would be the one to target that would give you the most bang for your buck, and whether that's even feasible. But here we're just doing sort of testing. They are computer units, Ks. Yeah. As I said, you'd have to then calibrate these time units to some other data set. Because these are, yeah. So this is now just relative units. Let me switch topics in the last 5 minutes or so. Give you a brief introduction of another type of model. So these are CFD models of procoagulant CTCs in the bloodstream. As I said, cancer patients have a higher than average incidence of blood clot formation leading to stroke. And that's because CTCs express tissue factor that triggers a complex chain of chemical reactions leading to thrombosis. And so this would be a nice little, this is an experiment that Owen McCarty did at OHSU. It's a breast cancer cell, I believe. And he's perfusing blood over and watching it, and it triggers the initial stages of blood clot formation here. So we're trying to do things like modeling based on these sorts of ideas. So what we're doing are models in the following type. This is a real brief introduction. Navier-Stokes equations for the fluid, even though blood is typically a non-Newtonian fluid, for this purpose is probably okay to treat it as a Newtonian incompressible fluid. That's the velocity field U. The cell would be a deformable circulating tumor cell. There's also a chemical concentration field, and there could be several of those, which link to the fluid velocity with different diffusion constants. Right now, we're just taking a linear concentration diffusion equation coupled to the flow. But key to our problem is this. As the flow velocity and the chemical concentration field evolve in time in a different geometric setting, we're going to track particles in this field because we are looking for regions of high concentration, and that regions of high concentration depend on the geometry and the flow and concentration and so forth. It's complicated. So we have to track regions of high concentration. So what we do is we take particles, which we think of as the sort of forming ingredients of these fibrin formation, and we move along concentration field gradients in that direction. We normalize them. So this would be the direction of flow, concentration field gradients. And we sort of do 1 over C. So in regions where there's low concentration, these particles move quickly. And in regions where there's high concentration, they move more slowly. So what we're looking for are regions of high concentration, which obviously are evolving in time. And so they're, so you'll see some of these simulations. Of course, viscous boundary conditions for the velocity field at the wall and the cell, and no penetration boundary condition for the concentration at the cell and the wall. All right. And we use some of the diffusion constants that we get from the literature. And this would be a typical kind of thing that we do. So we take, Peter extracts the circulating tumor cell. We get DIC information, images of these cells. We then input that into something called Cell Profiler, which gives us the a nice profile of the cell. And then we use that as an initial condition in a COMSOL simulation. And this would be a simple one. This is just a channel flow, just to get us going here. It's a little bit closer to the upper boundary, so it's rotating counterclockwise because of the viscous, boundary layer here. So it's turning this way. And it is deformable. There's not much action there. It's a short time simulation, but it is a deformable cell. And it's emitting this chemical field as it goes. And that's it. The COMSOL uses an adaptive finite element mesh for the flow and gives us as much information as we need in terms of velocity fields. And we input our own equations for the tracking of particles. So we do it various kinds of, so we look at lots of different things. So this would be a, what we think of as a sort of a dipole cluster of CTCs. And we put it in this kind of a geometry because we're interested in these concentration field buildup in regions where more than one CTC is together, because we think that would be a sort of a hot spot where a blood clot could form, particularly if it's in a, not in an open flow environment, but in a sort of a closed flow environment. So we do simulations along these lines. And then we put particles in there. These are concentration field particles that will find ridges of the concentration field in time. So we put those in at various times. What you can see is that they're sort of finding these ridges. Let's go to the next one. Right there, let's say, high concentration field ridges. This would be a cell cluster that we took. I like this simulation. And we put it in to see how this would block the flow here. You can see it deforming just a little bit, and it chokes off the flow. That's the velocity. And what happens here to the concentration field after it chokes off the flow, it basically starts diffusing along fronts that are constrained to the geometry. So initially, the concentration field is obviously constrained to the shape of the circulating tumor cell, but after a short or medium period of time, the shape of the circulating tumor cell doesn't matter so much anymore. It's more the geometry of the environment that it's in. Yeah. These are particle trackers that track the velocity field. dQ dt equals u. These are particle trackers that track the concentration field. It's not great, but for short times, they basically, as I said, outline the CTC shape, and for longer times, they move along fronts of the concentration. Yeah, do you have a question?
So here the initial condition is taken from the experimental effect.
Yeah.
And then that initial condition is let evolve in this type of
right.
channel.
Yeah.
So now, what sort of constitutive law or something is considered for this?
Yeah, there's a lot to say about that. So what we do in COMSOL is we take a two-fluid problem. So we have a fluid density inside the cell, we have a fluid density outside the cell, and we have an interface in which there's a surface tension. And we can tweak those parameters. So basically, this is a surface tension problem. Okay, that's how we control the deformability of the cell. So we're not modeling the internal mechanisms of the cell at this point.
So it's an incompressible fluid.
It's an incompressible fluid, yeah. Certain viscosity, density inside, different one outside. Yeah.
Is the surface tension uniform?
Yes. Yeah.
What Peclet numbers are associated with the diffusing guide?
Yeah. So we take those Peclet numbers, we take those from the literature. I can't tell you what exactly they are in this particular simulation, but we get them in this range. Let's see. That was why I showed you. So you'd have to, I don't write them in terms of Peclet numbers here. I write them in terms of diffusion constants. But you can compute the Peclet numbers from that. I don't know that we've done that. But those are the numbers we use, the range of the numbers. And it certainly matters.
It's water, right? In terms of the parameters of the fluid in the console.
The fluid outside of the cell is blood. We take the density of blood. Subject, no. Yeah.
Okay. And what is the Reynolds number of the flow?
Roughly small. Let's say 100.
One.
Well, one would be let's say near the boundary layer, and 100 or so. It's certainly not in the thousands. You're not really talking about Stokes flow, but you're not talking about jet. You're not talking about turbulent. I mean, it's turbulent probably, but that would be sort of in the middle of the. No. Certainly not. There are geometric situations in which you could be creating vortices, and we have seen simulations where we've tweaked these parameters, and we've actually seen sort of vortex shedding of the concentration field, but I'm not sure that that's a realistic situation.
So just to understand the Clausewitz situation better, so you showed a movie, the immediate flow setup in which there was a cluster, and then over a period of time you could see some sort of clock forming.
Yeah. Well, you see blockage of the velocity field, let's put it that way.
Here there is blockage of the velocity field. But there is an in vitro experiment where you showed Clark, there were some fibroblasts.
Right, yeah.
Gathering around. So that is formation of a clot.
Yeah.
And here, this is just flow field hindrance, right? Means what does a clot?
Oh, I see what you're asking. So our next step would be, so we're looking, we believe that it's the high concentration, chemical concentration regions that are going to be the hot spots for where those clots are going to form most likely. So our next step would be to add a reaction term into these equations that would produce that at these hot spots. That's why we're tracking these hot spots. So right now, you're right, we're just computing, we're just trying to visualize where the high concentration fields are.
And typically, what are the size of vessels where the clots form in case of cancer? It's due to cancer.
Yeah, I think I have that somewhere. I think I have that in the picture here. I mean, it depends on whether you're talking about venules or arteries. I mean, let's see. Yeah, here. Venule size.
Venule size.
these cells aren't active, they're actually thinking things which are blocking the upregulation of cells and their active stressing.
Not in our model right now. They're active in the sense that they deform.
The question I have is whether some platelets and things are actually moving around in flux.
They could well be. Yes, they could well be. I have no doubt that it's way more complex than what we have in our model at the moment.
I mean, your cell is just a bag of fluid, right?
Say it again?
Your cell is just a bag of fluid.
It's a bag of fluid with a different viscosity, different density than the outside fluid, but we currently don't have a nucleus in there. I mean, we could certainly do that. That's not that much harder. We would add a second component inside of the another bag with a higher viscosity and a higher density.
Right, but I think what Tom was referring to was more like
internal
force generations or things like that. Forces and stresses being generated inside this thing that you call the cell.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have that, it's just a fluid.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But there could even be an active mechanism due to a non-uniform circumstance. Mahamouni or something like that. I'm not sure whether it's important here, but...
Yeah.
Presumably the concentration field is not really uniform across the surface, is it?
No. No, it wouldn't be.
Just one final question. Sure. So these clocks, given the diameters range from 5 to 50, the clocks may also form because of single circuitry.
Because of a singular, as a
just post. A single, rather than plus,
absolutely. Okay. Sure. Sure. I mean, there have been experiments on that kind of a thing where you can sort of correlate the number, or let's say the density of circulating tumor cells to the time at which a blood clot forms. And roughly speaking, the more circulating tumor cells there are in a given geometry, the shorter the occlusion time would be. So there's, in some way, probably clusters and lots of CTCs are more dangerous than single CTCs. But it depends on the geometry. I mean, I can easily imagine that if a single CTC is in residence in a geometric situation where they're trapped for quite a while, and I could easily imagine that could cause more problems than a cluster going rapidly through an open channel. It's complicated. All right, let me finish up and just show you this last little thing. So we did, we built low-dimensional deformation models of the intravasation step. So we put Owen puts a breast cancer cell or other cancer cells on a slide, runs fluid over it and images it at different shear rates. We're ramping up the pressure gradient, and at some point, that cell breaks off into the flow. And we're looking at the deformation of that cell as you get different and different, higher and higher shear rates. And so what we do is we use something called active shape algorithms to take this sequence of images and build low-dimensional deformation models of these deforming cells based on these active shape models, which basically train the parameters in some sort of, let's say, an empirical constitutive equation based on this sort of a training set. And we use that in a Stokes flow simulation once they're trained by this experiment. So there's a whole story there that I probably can't get into. I'm here for the next couple of months if anybody wants to talk. So maybe I should stop there.
Thanks.
No questions right now?
In the first talk, you have you actually done some graph analysis of your nodes and this edge?
Yes, yes.
And did you apply something like a betweenness analysis or closeness?
Well, what we found, there's lots of things you could apply, and we've looked at lots of different things. What we have found to be pretty useful is the hub and authority classification of the different sites. So do you know what hub and authority sites are? They're basically like you're computing the left and right singular vectors of the transition matrix, and you're classifying each site as either a hub or an authority. They use that a lot in citation kind of problems, where a hub would be an example like of a review paper, which refers to lots of different papers, and an authority would be a paper that is referenced a lot. So we're classifying these sites as hubs and authorities. That's kind of the main tool that we found to be useful.
You get to some same conclusion?
No, everything, I mean, conclusions are slightly different. I mean, every story is a story unto itself. So I can't really say that there's one sort of single story that one could tell. But one thing to keep in mind is we are not talking about huge networks here. We're talking about networks that have 30, 40, or 50 sites. So we're not really doing statistical mechanics. Pretty small number.
The two-step and the three-step capacity positive determine conversion. Was there anything that really surprised the clinician?
Was there anything what?
That really surprised the clinician, or did they know some of this already?
Definitely, I've given this talk many times in front of clinicians who have said, we know all that already. And I would answer that that's great. I don't want to be building models that are completely orthogonal to what their intuition is, but they do not have any quantitative notion of how things develop, and there's absolutely no possible way you can build computer models based on a clinical intuition. So yes, a lot of this is consistent with what they know. They would certainly tell you that they know that bone is the first key metastatic site for prostate cancer. Probably a little bit of a surprise that adrenal gland and lung were so closely connected, but the key thing is that we're quantifying this and we can use this as a model that we can then make more and more complex.
What the fluid mechanical model can tell you about why from A goes to B and not to C?
Right, right. I think it's a really, really complicated, it's far away from where we're going here. To model this whole Markov thing from a fluid mechanics point of view and to build in all the ingredients that would do that, I don't really see that as a very good path. I think it's too complicated.
Well, but apparently it may be that different cancers have different elastic properties of the cells, and so
they definitely do.
So they change parameters in your model.
They definitely do, but I mean those changes, the differences in the parameters associated with different cancers are going to be pretty small compared to the importance of the genetic and other factors that go into play in terms of whether the seed is compatible with the soil. So to build a model where fluid mechanics is sort of front and center and is the determining factor is probably not the way to go. Not to say that this is going to be some component of it, but it's just, you just have to have other, right now this is just whole body, large scale information. We're not, in a sense, we're not building in genetic information, although obviously that's in there in the data set.
So if you are talking about genetic information, it means that something else determines it.
It's all of these things.
Penetration or something else, not the transport through the blood.
No, I wouldn't put it that way either. I would say it's probably all of those things. It's going to be transport through the blood. It's going to be genetic information. It's going to be individual patient's biochemistry. It's going to be all of those things.
So the blood transport would be also influenced by these genetic factors?
Certainly. Yeah, I mean, it's not a simple story to tell.
So in terms of implications, going back to the first tool, implications for therapy, mm-hmm. I mean, you assume if people are on a particular form of cancer and with a study group of 10,000 people, and you should have sufficient statistics to actually try and develop your network simulation onto actual sort of possible therapy. Have you thought about doing that? Or?
Mean getting therapeutic data sets?
Yeah, and if the drug's targeting a certain organ, right. And then it's right. Reducing this sort
right.
Of
drug. Right, so we are doing some of that now, but just to give you an idea of the kind of size of the data sets that are considered fantastic, the Sloan Kettering data set that we have is a breast cancer data set over 12 years, and it has, I think it has 500 or 600 patients in it, and it's very low.
And becomes so specific? Or is it
no. These are all patients that walked in the door, not at the same day, obviously, but over a period of a couple of years, and they all had primary breast cancer with no mets. So that was great.
Yeah.
We like that. And they tracked them, and I think 277 of them have died. So now we have an even smaller data set of people who have died.
Yeah, yeah.
And then some of those we throw out because they die of other reasons. We're down to 200 or so.
Right.
And then of those 200, they're all treated differently.
Right.
Some of them are 30-year-olds, others are 70-year-olds. So you could sub in according to age. Now you're down to 50, 60, 70. And then some have had mastectomies, others have different kinds of therapies. You're talking about small numbers here.
How about rats or mice, just to make sure it works?
Right, no, that is a. So one of the keys to our physical science oncology center is that we do not work on mice or rats. We are only working on humans.
Just so people have such well-defined cancers and some of these.
There are millions of people that work on mice and rats, and there's lots of stuff you can do with them, but you are always left with the problem of translating that information into humans.
Sure, yeah.
And you spend your whole life working on rat and mouse models, and we're not doing that, so we're only working on human models.
There is continuing with the question that was previously presented. So there are all these different parameters which can affect propensity of metastasis or whether a site is, whether soil is good enough for
right.
to grow and
right. like
that. So when we consider all of these details, the specificity do matter, as clinicians put it. And so are there any data sets on which one can do similar study, which is a very beautiful study, with a very specific information rather than just a plan? Like here you are talking about tumor already formed in certain cells.
Right.
So are there any specific information about either some heterogeneity or some gene expression?
Sure, there are lots of data sets out there, and so key is to find a good data set. So another data set source that we're looking at right now is the VA data set, the Veterans Administration, which is a massive data set in many ways. But it, you know, all of these medical data sets are they contain different kinds of information, and so you basically have to spend a lot of time trying to mine this data to figure out what it has in it and whether you can use it to build models. So I don't know the answer to that really. I mean, my best guess would be there are data sets out there that will give us information that we can use, but I can guarantee you it's not going to be a pristine, beautiful data set with Google-level numbers. Yeah.
It would be really interesting to make for rats the same study. And if the results are completely different, then you will prove that the studying of rats is useless.
I think there's no need to prove that. I mean, not useless, but I mean, everybody would agree that there's a big step in going from rats to people. Yeah.
A simple question is, I think, connected to what she asked.
Yeah.
You have a Markov matrix for the n squared component. You have one zero eigenvector, eigenvalue component.
Right.
You have a row sum.
Right.
That's 2n constraint sums n squared matrix. How do you get anything different?
Well, okay. Did you have a separate question? I can talk to you about that after. Yeah.
My question was, like, 1.5 million new cases of cancer in the United States every year, right? Roughly, that's the estimate. So why are these data sets so small?
Every cancer is different. Every clinic is different. Every doctor is different. Doctors scribble stuff down. There's no uniform method of taking data. So there's no uniformity is the short answer to that question.
I guess you also said that you only want the patients that were one starts taking data when the cancer is not yet metastasized
right.
in any way.
Right.
So that's already massive.
Right. So once you start building models, you are already...
Why couldn't you also use patients so somebody who's seen as breast cancer has already spread the bone that probably your thing is the most likely? Why couldn't you start taking data from there?
We could do that. We could certainly do that. Okay, so maybe we can talk about that. All right, thanks.